may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Travis Gunn, McGuire Woods, here on behalf of appellant David Myers. With me at counsel's table is Mr. Robert Lofton. I would like to reserve 2 of my minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
As this court is aware, this appeal presents a lot of issues. We were able to condense the 17 assignments of error that were granted to about 8. On brief, we continue to rely upon all
of our arguments. We appreciate that act of mercy.
We rely upon all of our arguments made on brief, and for purposes of today, with the court's indulgence, I would like to direct its attention to 3 issues. Those are the issues of waiver of arguments on appeal, insufficiency of the evidence, and the Anders issue that encompasses the exclusion of alibi witness testimony. Now, as to waiver, candidly, my original preparation for this issue sort of fell by the wayside last Thursday when this court issued its opinion in SRS versus Airbus Americas. Now, I read the SRS opinion and I read footnote 4, which concluded with this court saying, "We decline to adopt such a rule now." And of course, the rule the court was referring to was the rule we've articulated on brief in this case, argued that applies here. That is, unbriefed appellate arguments are waived, even by the respondent appellee, even at the petition stage. Now, recognizing that SRS says what it says, the only point I would like to make today
but
is...
But no published or unpublished order or opinion of either the Court of Appeals or the Virginia Supreme Court has held that.
Well, Your Honor, we would suggest that John Crane versus Hardin explains the principle, and then obviously the Rule 518B incorporates Rule 528D, which
getting to the heart of it, though, a petition is a request to hear the case. It's not necessarily framing the appellee's positions in all instances. And it would be pretty strong medicine, even too strong for the strongest of us, to want to force lawyers to exhaust everything that needs to be said or face waiver in a brief and op.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that Code 17.1-308 and this Court's Rule 5:3 recognize that the petition stage is not a dress rehearsal. It's not a trial run. It can be a 3-justice panel of this Court can actually decide the petition on the merits and actually reverse and remand for further proceedings.
Well, of course, and bear in mind that the court can also sua sponte raise 525 as well as 518, and we've very recently done that. So all I'm saying is it's a dramatic expansion of procedural default principles that you're asserting, and I don't know of any basis for it.
Well, Your Honor, we respectfully just rely upon the analysis that we, I think, was clearly set forth in the reply brief that simply just goes through 518, 528, 527. We cited Callaway versus Commonwealth, we cited John Crane versus Hardick, and I note that even at the United States Supreme Court stage, the United States Supreme Court has recognized that respondents to petitions can actually waive arguments and are not presented at the petition stage. But recognizing Your Honor's comments, I would like to turn to the insufficiency of the evidence. And on this point, Mr. Myers is just asking this court to apply the rule that can be synthesized from this court's cases. And that rule is this. In every case, the Commonwealth bears the burden to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, the identity of the criminal agent. However, different circumstances of different cases may require the Commonwealth to produce different facts to meet that burden and take the issue of identity to the jury. So, for example, we have Burroughs versus Commonwealth, in which the victim said, "All right, my assailant, he was a blonde-headed gentleman, and he sat in trial, looked at the defendant, and said, and it looks like that gentleman there."
Yeah, two of the victims identified the defendant, right?
Your Honor, two of the victims said one of the intruders was David Myers. Yes,
right.
Your Honor.
So, and one said, "Well, he was in. I interacted with him a week before." Now, Gray's wearing a mask, so that's a little tougher. But even if we cast that aside, the other victim said, "Well, I've known him since I was a teenager." And so, if someone has known someone for a long time and, can recognize speech patterns, voice, skin tone, eyes, whatever, why isn't that enough?
Well, because... And I think you hit the point, Your Honor, is that in this case, as in Fawn versus Commonwealth and as in Hammer versus Commonwealth, when the criminal agents were wearing masks, this court approved eyewitness identification testimony as being sufficient when the eyewitnesses articulated observational facts about the criminal agent, so not the defendant. And so that way, the jury had the facts that could connect the criminal agents
Unpack that for me. I'm not sure I follow.
Sure.
Observational facts.
Right. So in Fawn and in Hammer, the eyewitnesses said, all right, the guys that came in, or in Hammer, the guy who attacked me, you know, they had a certain nationality, they had a certain height, a certain weight, I recognized the sound of their voices. So all facts about the criminal agent.
So bare identification is insufficient. You would need detail.
In our circumstances, yes, Your Honor. This is not a case where Maurice saw David Myers walking down the street without a mask on, without anything obscuring his features, and goes, hey, look, I know that guy. I've known that guy for 20 years. That's David Myers. That's not this case. We have two intruders who are described by Edward Fox as they were wearing hoodies. One had on a mask and a hoodie. The other one had the hoodie put on so tight you could only see the eyes. And so in those circumstances, yes, the jury needs to be given facts so they can evaluate that Maurice and Charissa would be able to tie facts to these criminal agents to the defendant, Mr. Myers. And so, for example, and this is comes out in other cases, such as Hyde versus Commonwealth, in which the victim described her assailant as a tall white man, and even in those circumstances, this court said, well, that's not sufficient to prove.
Does that kind of formalism risk eroding the role of the jury as fact finder, though? I mean, why? In other words, why isn't that somewhat? You know, you impeach the witness. You say, look, you don't give that level of detail and all that, and so why should you be believed? And then the jury just makes the call.
Your Honor, no. The answer is no. It does not erode the role of the jury because all the court is doing is making sure that there are actual facts about the criminal agent and the defendant, that there need to be both facts about both sets of individuals. So in Fawn and in Hammer, we had a whole bunch of facts about the criminal agents that were then tied to the defendant. In Burroughs and in Hyde, there were a little bit of facts. It was a blonde-headed guy. It was a tall white man. And this court said, well, you know, that's just not really sufficient. But in this case, all we have is the two intruders are guys, and they are wearing hoodies, and one has a mask. Those are the only facts about those criminal agents, and the facts we have about Mr. Myers is, well, he's a guy, and he apparently has lived in Petersburg for a while. And so there's just a lack of facts. If there were facts, if any of these witnesses, and we're not saying it's impossible, of course not, if any of these witnesses, if Maurice or Charissa said, I've known him for a while, I've known him for 20 years, and I recognize the way he walked, he had a limp, or, you know, I recognize that cologne, then there are facts, and that then is sufficient to take the issue of identification to the jury. But there were none of those facts in this case, and that is why it was insufficient as a matter of law.
Do you know of any other court that has that kind of gloss on identification?
Candidly, Your Honor, I didn't look to any other court's case law. I was just basing off of Burroughs.
I mean, it always gives a court a comfort level when you say, well, a whole bunch of other courts have done this, and it's worked fine. As opposed to, you know, striking out in a novel direction.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully would push back against that. Unlike the Commonwealth that tried to actually cite this court's cases that focus on eyewitness and identification testimony, we have basically a continuum of evidence from this court's cases. At the far end, we have Fawn, we have Hammer, where there is actual facts. Then we get into Hyde and Burroughs, which I respectfully suggest there this court said, you know, these are a little bit of facts, but they're not sufficient. So our case is not novel. We are just at less facts than in Hyde and less facts than in Burroughs.
Okay.
Moving on from the insufficiency of the evidence issue, unless there are any further questions, turning to the Anders error. So even if this court were to disagree with us on the insufficiency of the evidence issue, the Commonwealth's case relied upon that bare identification of Mr. Myers for their case in chief. And in those circumstances, Mr. Ernest Jones' testimony would have been alibi witness testimony. It would have bolstered Mr. Myers' testimony that he was at Sheila Crockett's house the Sunday of the shooting, and would have undermined Sheila Crockett's two other scenarios.
The Commonwealth points out this is sort of an odd claim, because it's not a situation where the defense is saying, here's my next witness. And the court says, no, that's cumulative, or that's irrelevant, or that's whatever. Instead, it's the colloquy with the defendant to figure out, are we ready to go to trial, or do I have a problem at the outset that might necessitate a continuance or something? So, what's your response to that? Because maybe it's a habeas claim, I don't know, but it seems odd as a claim of trial court error where the counsel explains, no, I looked into this, I just don't think he's helpful.
Well, I would agree with Your Honor's observation that it certainly is odd, it's a unique situation, but what is important is that after, once again, saying not guilty, each one of his charges during the arraignment, the court said, all right, I'm not going to accept your not guilty pleas. Instead, we're going to have a conversation, Mr. Myers. I'm going to figure out a couple things about this case. There's a few questions, and then then the court looked to David Myers, not his counsel, said, are there any witnesses you want to have called? And that was at 2:39. There's a short, quick exchange between counsel and circuit court, David Myers, who do you want to have called in this case? And that's at 2:41. And then we do have, from 2:41 to 2:47, we have David Myers and counsel explaining what Sheila Crockett's want to testify to. All three scenarios get mentioned. And so the circuit court is aware of what's going to happen at trial insofar as Sheila Crockett's changing her testimony. She has these different multiple scenarios. And then at the end of that, at 2:47 to 2:48, the circuit court says, all right, Mr. Jones, I understand the arguments. I understand you want to call Ernest Jones as an alibi witness testimony, but that's not going to be alibi witness testimony. And so I understand what the court's observing about David Myers' prior point of counsel's position on this issue, but the circuit court did make a decision, and it did make a holding that was, Mr. Myers, you cannot call Ernest Jones because he will not provide alibi witness testimony.
Was he even there? Second.
He didn't say he couldn't call him. He said he was not an alibi witness, right?
So explicitly he said he is not going to provide alibi witness testimony.
Right.
In the context of the conversation, Your Honor, that is when Mr. Myers said, I want to call Ernest Jones, he said it 2 or 3 times, and the court was like, look, I hear what you're saying, Mr. Myers, but that's not alibi witness testimony, which is why you're telling me you want to call him, so we're going to move on.
Is he even there to be called?
The record does not reflect that. What the record does reflect is that a notice of alibi witnesses had been filed with the court, and Ernest Jones had been identified. And of course, the court controls this docket. You could call it a recess.
You know, under habeas law, there are certain fundamental decisions that belong to the defendant. You know, whether to testify, whether to plead guilty, whether to have an appeal. And there's a whole lot of stuff that's left to the discretion of counsel: how to examine witnesses, which witnesses to call, what to investigate, and so on. So, isn't that in the wheelhouse of counsel to figure out, you know, look, I looked into this guy, and I just don't plan on calling him because I don't think he really helps me. Why would we shift that over to the defendant and say, no, that was the defendant's call to make?
Well, Your Honor, I think you observed correctly that this is a unique situation. In the context of habeas, this might be an argument about, is this strategy, is this something that might be overturned on a habeas, or addressed on a habeas point? But here, in the context of this conversation, we have the court doing something it did not have to do. We're not saying that the court was required to do this. It was voluntarily diving into what Mr. Myers wanted to do. Were there any witnesses that Mr. Myers wanted to say call? And they talked about Ernest Jones. They talked about Sheila Crockett. And the circuit court said, well, I hear and I understand what you're saying. Ernest Jones is not alibi witness testimony.
You had requested 2 minutes of rebuttal time. You're getting
Thank
close.
You, Your Honor.
All right.
Good morning, Mayor. This is the court, Jim Murphy from the Commonwealth. Your Honor, first on the waiver, I think it's clear that there's no authority whatsoever for the claim that not having raised a claim or an argument in the Clinton op forecloses the possibility of raising that in the brief, when the brief is actually filed.
Particularly since a brief and op is not even mandatory to
That's
be filed.
Correct. I mean, you know, we would be in serious difficulty if we're not that rule.
We'd be defaulting maybe 20% of our caseload if we held to that rule.
Yes, sir. So I think the Callaway case is helpful because they had a situation where there was a waiver because of different standards for the assignments of error at the petition stage and at the
The appellee just occupies a different position as the prevailing party than the appellant, and different rules apply.
Yes, sir. So I think we can make... I think it's clear that there's no authority whatsoever for that proposition. Now, on the sufficiency, I mean, there is probably a waiver here. It's not awful. Defense counsel said, judge, it's just a credibility issue. And he first may have made a pro forma motion to strike after the Commonwealth's case. At the end of all the evidence, he said, "Judge, credibility, I'm not going to make a motion." So the defense counsel didn't even think there was any merit to the
I mean, the standard of review probably carries you across the finish line, but it is mighty thin. I mean, to have two masked individuals, and then the one victim says, "Well, I met him the week before, and then initially can't identify him," and then changes her story, and then the other person says that he's known him since he was 12, but initially can't identify him, only knows a nickname. There's at least some possible motive for fingering this guy. There's a history between these two. So the standard of review is what it is, but, you know, eyewitnesses is tough enough without masks, and so it's just, it is what it is.
I understand what you're saying, but of course, the one thing you might say is that the victim was, in fact, shot, had been shot at the time he made the identification.
Right, was medicated and all that.
As soon as you recovered at the hospital, you pointed out that it wasn't, in fact, David Myers. And I think, that, of course, is just jury for the jury. I mean, there's certainly, we have two people who said this is the man, and the no reason why, I mean, there's credibility, as the defense counsel said, and there's certainly enough evidence to get this through the motion to strike even up to the jury. Now, on the alibi, that's not an unusual case. Nothing unusual at all about this call. It happens all the time. Where we have a defendant who's more involved in the trial than some others, these issues come up. About, well, I want to call this witness, my lawyer doesn't want to do that. And that could get to habeas. But in this case, the attorney's decision made perfect sense. Sheila Crockett had told the police and had told this lawyer when he interviewed her, yes, he came to my house, he was there at 7:30, but then he left for an hour or an hour and a half. And during that period is the time when the crimes occurred. So the defense counsel said, I'm not going to call her because she doesn't really help you. She was, in fact, called by the Commonwealth because the Commonwealth used her. So what Jones would show was that he had driven the defendant to Sheila Crockett's house. And he was there at 7:30. Well, Sheila Crockett, in her original testimony, said, yes, he did come at 7:30, but then he left. So Ernest Jones' testimony didn't help in the least. All it did was say he got there, which we could get from Sheila Crockett, the defendant could get. But he couldn't disprove the fact that he had, in fact, left for sufficient time to commit the crimes. The defendant argued on brief that, yes, but when Sheila finally testified, she said, no, he hadn't come that night at home. He wasn't there that night. They said, well, at that point, he could contradict her testimony, that he could say, yes, he was there that night. But, of course, that wasn't known to the judge when he made his decision, whatever it was, on that issue. And nobody ever said thereafter, judge, now this is different. Let's let him testify to contradict her trial testimony. So clearly,
did the trial judge actually make a decision at all? Going back to Justice Goodman,
I'm having a problem phrasing that. That's what's unusual. He's just trying to figure out the dispute between the client, and he says, "I think your attorney's justified in this position." So, and he is not truly. He is not an alibi witness, if that's in fact all he's going to say. And he didn't really make a decision. And the lawyer could have called Jones after the testimony by Sheila Crockett that he wasn't there at any time that night. But they didn't choose to. There's no reason to believe the judge would have prevented that. But it never happened. And the judge handled this case perfectly. The Court of Appeals and the attorney did what they had to do. The attorney presented a brief. He said there were some issues the defendant would like to raise. Sufficiency. The Court of Appeals actually went into the sufficiency issue. Court of Appeals said, okay, we're going to grant you a continuance, let the petitioner file a supplemental petition, they then reviewed everything, found nothing, and I think they were entirely correct and requested to do a firm decision.
Thank you. Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. On this insufficiency point, Mr. Murphy just pointed out that we had two eyewitnesses who just sat on the stand and said it was him. And in Burroughs versus Commonwealth, there was a victim eyewitness who said it was him, it was the defendant. And this court said that was not sufficient.
Did that person know the defendant for 20 years?
No, Your Honor, but that person did say that my attacker was blonde-headed, and the defendant was blonde-headed, and I would suggest that this court said, well, that's not sufficient to reasonably interpret facts that connect the agent to the defendant. With respect to the alibi situation, JA 241 to 247, the counsel and Mr. Myers set forth all three scenarios that Sheila Crockett was going to testify to. I heard again, as well as on brief, the Commonwealth saying, well, look, at the time the decision was made, the circuit court didn't really understand what was going to happen at trial. At 242 to 244, both counsel and David Myers talked about, sure, she was going to say that I showed up and I left, but we're saying that I showed up and I stayed the whole time. And then from 245 to 246, counsel says, you know what, Sheila Crockett's just changing her testimony all this time. She doesn't know what it is. In fact, for all I know, she's going to say that he never showed up on Sunday. So for the reasons stated, we ask this court to enter the relief request. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess for 15 minutes and will resume oral arguments at 5 minutes till 11.
All rise.